House Resources Committee to order. It's Monday, March 5th, and the time is 1:04 p.m. Members present at this time, Representative Chris Birch, Representative Justin Parrish, Representative Dave Tallarico, Representative George Rauscher, Representative Harriet Drummond, alternate Representative Chris Tuck, co-chair Representative Andy Josephson, and myself, Representative Garen Tarr. Please let the record reflect that we do have a quorum to do business. If we could kindly ask everyone to silence their cell phones at the start of the meeting, we'd appreciate that. Assisting us today is our recording secretary, Debbie Tillinghast. Thank you so much. And I'm learning your Max from the LIO helping us with that. So thank you so much to both of them. This afternoon, we're going to hear House Bill 355, Fire, Forest, Land, Crimes, and Prevention. This is Representative Guttenberg's bill. Then we're going to transition into the presentation on food security in Alaska. And then finally, we'll have the presentation from the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission. So, Representative Guttenberg, if you could please come forward. And as we're getting started, we'll have Representative Guttenberg do a quick recap of his bill, and then we have a number of amendments to consider. There are five amendments that came in before the amendment deadline, and then there's a sixth amendment laying on your desk that did not come in time to meet the deadline, and so we'll talk about that when we get there. But at this time, we do have the five amendments, and Representative Guttenberg, if you'd like to put yourself on the record and remind us again before we go into the amendments of the components of the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for hearing the bill again. The bill, I won't say it's a simple bill, but the bill deals with fire safety and fire suppression and fire education. It seeks to restructure the way fines are levied. It's called a bail. That's kind of confusing, but it's basically whether you get a ticket or have to go to court, or they're pursuing you because you deliberately set a fire that caused considerable damage. There's a component that deals with a fire safety, and part of it is just clarification when the department has the ability to be on your property right now. If it's post-fire and they need to investigate, they need your permission. If you don't give your permission, and if they need to, they have to go to and get a warrant. And this is clarifying that language, all of that language.
Thank you. Any questions for the bill sponsor before we start to consider amendments?
Madam Chair.
Mm-hmm. Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So would it be like the same thing with a criminal investigation for the police department also, where does the police department have to go get a subpoena before they come in?
The situation in this case is if there's a fire, and it's not a home fire, that's a different authority. But if there's a fire and it goes through your property, they have the ability to suppress and control and put it out. If there's a need to come back after the fact to investigate because there was no investigator there or they need more information, then they either get your permission, or if you deny it and they need to, they have to go get a warrant.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
No? Any other questions? Okay. Then we will go ahead and go to amendments. And for anyone following along, just to make sure we're all on the same version, we're looking at House Bill 355. That's 30-LS1382/D. And so all of the amendments should be D something as we look at them and make sure you have the right thing. And as we're going into these, want to just make members know aware that Chris Mesh, the director of the Division of Forestry, is online, Tom Kurth from the Division of Forestry in Fairbanks, and then Ann Nelson from Department of Law in Anchorage are all available for questions related to this bill. Representative Rauscher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate you. At this time, I'd like to move Amendment Number 1.
Okay. Object for purposes of discussion.
I appreciate that. Amendment Number 1, it meets the goal of this bill, providing clarity to the statutes for all Alaska. This amendment limits the times when forestry officials can enter onto private property. By deleting the word anytime on page 2, line 12, and then inserting when responding to a wildland fire or suspected fire. It further, the amendment deletes the term destructive agent from the allowable times that a division rep can access the property without permission from the owner. This amendment preserves the property rights of the owner, the privacy of the owner, and if there's any need, Daryl has the definition of destructive agent and regulations requiring the property owner to address, remove, or destructive agents. Basically, what I'm worried about here is the fire has under their control while they're fighting the fire, and that means any of the properties around it that could be in danger at that time, I understand that. But once they've left, and say there's a court case that was started maybe 2 months later or something, or maybe even a year later, according to this being any time, they can just walk on a person's property, any one of the people, even if it wasn't where the fire originated from. It just may have passed through or whatever. Now they have the right to enter all of those private properties anytime they feel like because of the word anytime. And basically what I'm just trying to do is give them the leeway during the fire, which is what I believe we heard they wanted, which is to be able to respond to an investigation while the fire is underway, while they're fighting it, while they're mopping up, while they're in control of it, while their engine is parked there or whatever. As long as they have the control of that fire, I understand that they're going to probably want to be able to investigate the cause while they're there. But I think after that, they should probably be able to notify the owner, and that's the reason for the bulk of this this amendment.
Okay. Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Rauscher, just a couple questions. I don't understand the destructive agent deletion and reinsertion, which is part of the amendment. Am I missing something there?
I appreciate that. Well, if the definition of destructive agent has stuff like bugs, okay, in part of the destructive agent. Now, say they were to come on the property for killing bugs, you see, that's not a real good reason to just access any business, any property at any time. So I think that's why destructive agent should be omitted there for that particular part of the sentence.
And why don't we see if Ann Nelson from the Department of Law, if you want to weigh in on this, because what it looks to me is that it's being deleted but inserted and deleted again, and so I think it the end result is that it won't be there. Is Ms. Correct. Nelson available?
It's because it's deleting a part of statute which already exists.
Mm-hmm. Yes, through the chair, this is Ann Nelson with the Department of Law, and I am on the line, and I have to say I'm confused by what the amendment is trying to accomplish with respect to destructive agent. As well, is the intention to take that language out of Section 3?
It looks like the amendment is for Section 3, and right now the language, or of any organization authorized to prevent, control, or suppress a fire or a destructive agent, and so that language is in there now, and what the amendment will do will delete the destructive agent language. And Representative Rauscher was saying that that could mean that they had access to the property for bug control or something like that rather than fire suppression.
Is that correct? Mm-hmm. Daryl, you have the – could I have Daryl
come? Let's take a brief at ease. Daryl, if you wouldn't mind putting yourself on the record, and then if you could share that with us.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Daryl Brees, Staff Representative George Rauscher. For the record, the definition of destructive agent can be found in statutes 41.15.170. Number two, destructive agent means an insect, pathogen, or other environmental agent that causes damage to a forest resource. And of interest as well, is regulation, if we're talking about insects, Division of Forestry Regulation 41 AAC 9595 puts the onus on addressing insects wholly on the property owner. and it puts the on the Division of Forestry just approval of the method that the property owner is using, approval or non-approval. So any action being taken to address insects and what is the primary thing that's addressed in destructive agent is on the homeowner, on the property owner, not on the Division of Forestry. So that's the purpose for the amendment. Representative Parrish kind of alluded to why we're deleting destructive agent in the amendment, and then it has the in brackets deleting, because it's currently in statute. Mm-hmm. We're deleting it from the bill now, and then we're deleting it from statute with the bracket deleting the language overall.
Mm-hmm. And just before we go to questions, so that we don't spend time, we don't need to, Mr. Mache, if he's available.
Yes, hi, I'm online. This is Chris Mache, Director of the Division of Forestry.
And so just to summarize what we're considering under this in terms of the removal of destructive agent, because that's currently in statute, do you want to speak to why that's currently in statute and if there's any problem with removing that?
Yes, Madam Chair, I could speak to that. So this reference has context with both the state's Forest Resources and Practices Act and an earlier section of this statute, which is 4115.020, which gives the commissioner the power to make regulations for addressing fire and destructive agents. So this definition is used in numerous places in statute. On the forest practices side, the commissioner has the authority as needed by emergency situations to declare a zone of infestation, and then emergency regulations as needed to address something like a bark beetle outbreak, which would be the one instance I can think of that would be of sufficient seriousness to potentially use something like this. Although I would say the division in its history has not needed to make use of this statutory authority, but it does exist for that reason.
Okay. I saw Representative Josephson and then Birch had questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Director Mache, I'm looking at the amendment, and what at issue in terms of right of entry would be, as I understand this, a state wildlife fire officer like yourself could access Chugach National Forest land, and you could do so. Now, I don't know if there's some supremacy issue, but you could do so under current law at any time to prevent, suppress, or control wildland fire or destructive agent. This amendment would say, as to destructive agent, you couldn't do that, and also it says you couldn't do that unless you were responding to a wildland fire or suspected fire. So if the goal of the maker of the amendment was to somehow protect privacy interests of John Doe, a property holder in Alaska, is this would also seem to reach across public lands, this prohibition?
Yes, through the chair to Representative Josephson. Yes, I didn't speak to that aspect of the amendment. I just narrowed my comments to the destructive agent piece, but that would be a concern. I do think in other statutory authorities, we have the ability to, like I said, declare a zone of infestation. That would help us address an issue of insects or disease, although I would read this fairly narrowly as you've described when it refers to wildland fire or suspected fire, and there could be some potential conflicts between the two.
And if I could
follow?
I guess I would also tell, although I have some, so I have some concerns about the expansiveness of the section under the bill and under the law as it exists. You know, my understanding of criminal procedure is that a person could still file motion practice and say, notwithstanding this statute or this bill, something should be suppressed because someone's rights weren't read to them or a warrant should have issued, although one would think that this might support the state's argument that a warrant wasn't necessary at all times. But I'm saying there could still be an assortment of motion practice in criminal court, theoretically. I just wanted to sort of make that point.
Representative Birch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I see that the term destructive agent appears in multiple locations in this in the bill, and I guess my question is too. I mean, the title of the bill relates generally to, you know, burning and negligent burning and everything related to fire. I had noticed, frankly, that a destructive agent component here, and I guess I am somewhat sympathetic to. You know, opening the door, well, it sounds like it's been opened already, but as to, does this mean that you the Division of Forestry can like quarantine property, or what if I have a neighbor that's he's got a whole bunch of dead standing trees? Is that a I guess I'm trying to envision a situation where destructive agents would you know, engage the Division of Forestry to come out and, you know, go on to public or private land to do something, and whether that would be with consent or could be done without consent of the property owner. Through the chair.
Yeah, through the chair, this is Chris Mage, Director of the Division of Forestry, Representative Birch. I cannot think of a unilateral case that we would take an action to enter property without first going through, like I mentioned earlier, the forest practices pieces of our statutory authority that would involve the commissioner and a justification and a best interest finding to establish what we would call a zone of infestations. That could be insects or diseases or other pathogens. And then enacting emergency regulations on how we would intend to deal with that, which could mean treatments on private lands. But there would be a more exhaustive process to go through besides us just making a unilateral decision as the division that we would take action under this statute. This statute's really focused on the fire piece.
Okay, just for follow-up, Madam Chair. So this exists now. This accommodation already exists, isn't that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Birch, that is correct.
Okay, thank you.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I'd like to point out to the committee that the section that we're amending with this amendment, 4115040, deals specifically with the right of entry to control and to suppress fires. So the forestry would have a right, if this section is amended, to enter for any other reasons for, if it's, this is just dealing with controlling and suppressing fires. So if they do have to enter, as Mr. Mace said, or investigator declare a zone of insect infestation, they would still be allowed to. We're just trying to limit the entry when they're controlling and suppressing fires with the changes that we're suggesting here.
Any other questions? Representative Parrish.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The section at present covers suppressing and controlling wildland fires or destructive agents. It also covers preventing, and if this bill were to become law, it also cover investigating the potential fire or actual fire destructive agent. It would worry me if the, let's see, authorized agents or the employees of the, if the employees of the division couldn't go onto land in order to prevent a fire or to investigate a fire, prevent a fire before the fact, before they're responding to a wildland fire or suspected fire, they just hear that someone's doing something which could lead to a wildland fire, or after a fire, perhaps they're too busy responding to the fire in other areas to dispatch an investigator back to try to figure out the source. At present, I think it's overly restrictive, and I can't support it.
Any other comments? Representative Drummond.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I haven't heard that the destructive agent is an issue or has been an issue through the comments of the commissioner of the forestry division director. And if some of these insects, diseases, or pathogens contribute to the danger of fire in terms of creating, of killing standing trees and causing them to become even better fuel for a fire. I think the destructive agent has to be part of the assessment by the professionals in fire prevention, and I don't see any reason to remove it. I can't support that amendment.
Any other comments?
None, Chair.
We'll do closing comments. Representative Rauscher, just wanted to see if anybody else had questions.
Just,
Representative Josephson.
Just briefly, I'm also going to be opposing it. I think that, as written, the law allows a fire officer, for lack of a better term, to enter land, public and private, for the purpose of preventing prospective fires because of destructive agents like bug infestations. And I don't have enough knowledge to know, to say that that should be prohibited. I also don't, I think it includes public land, and that's probably most of the land that they would access. And so I don't want to encumber a fire official's ability to go and inspect public land. So I'm going to be opposing the amendment.
And, oh, additional comment.
Did you have a comment as well?
Yeah, I kind of have a question.
Okay, we'll go here, and then here. And then we'll have to wrap up for this for today.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. This is existing language, and I'm trying to figure out, when I read the sentence, that upon approval by the commissioner or an authorized agent, an employee from the Division of Forestry or any organization authorized to prevent, control, or suppress a fire or a destructive agent. I'm not sure if they're trying to say prevent a destructive agent, control a destructive agent, or suppress a destructive agent. I'm not quite getting that sentence. I know it's existing statute, but just for some reason I'm just not getting that. But my understanding is possibly that this destructive agent needs to be administered, maybe be administered. I mean, I don't know if there's any type of bug repellent or whatever for spruce beetle, which could be a cause of a concern. I'm not sure if they're talking about as destructive agent, as a matter of fact, as it being a matter of being flammable. I'm just not quite getting it. So I don't know if we have someone from Director of Forestry that can answer that question on what's the intent of that.
Director Mache, did you hear that question?
Yes, for the record again, Chris Mache, Director of Division of Forestry. And destructive agent, as we heard earlier, was defined in statute, and again, just means insect pathogen or environmental agent, and can cause damage to the forest resource. As pointed out earlier, if we have dead standing timber, whatever the cause, for any of those reasons, that fuel source is much more receptive and dangerous to wildland fire than a standing green forest. So destructive agent is rather broad, as it is defined. In context of forestry operations, it would primarily be for spruce bark beetle infestations. And if any of you are familiar with the Kenai and the situations we had there with that particular insect, it was fairly substantial and crossed all ownerships, regardless of whether it was public or private. So I don't know if that helps you with your interpretation of that, but prevent, control, and suppress all have specific meanings in forestry.
Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the purpose of having this in this section is for checking to see if a landowner is applying something that potentially could be flammable and or something needs to be applied to preserve the trees and keep them from drying out and becoming a fire hazard.
Through the chair again, Representative. Not necessarily. We wouldn't be checking out what someone was applying, but an example would be if someone has cut a lot of timber on their land for whatever reason and they've not properly treated the slash or disposed of the material, it becomes a breeding source for the insects, and then the insects can spread from their land onto neighbors' lands or other adjoining public lands. So that would be the reason one of our forestry people would need access to a piece of property.
And follow up, Madam Chair.
Yes, and then Representative Guttenberg has to go, so we'll have to we're going to have to wrap this up here in just a minute or two.
Okay, so just the one last question. So if you come up on a property, piece of property, and some timbers have been cut down, they're stacked up, and from what I'm hearing, there are some regulations that they have to treat that that lumber or debris according to whatever we have there. And if the, so the purpose of this is to be able to inspect to see if they've treated it with a proper destructive agent. Is I'm hearing that correctly?
Through the chair, Representative, yes, that would be correct. It would either be a control method, and there's numerous control methods to how you can keep a insect infestation or potential infestation like that under control. It's how the splash is treated. It could be chemical treatment. It could be a physical treatment such as bucking. It could be burning or burial. There's many ways to do that, and those are addressed under the Forest Practices Act, separate statute.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Drummond had a quick comment.
It actually isn't that quick. I think if we're going to hold this bill and continue, I'll keep it for next time. But I do want to recognize that any organization authorized to prevent, control, or suppress a fire includes any one of the fire departments in our communities, volunteer or paid. And I can tell you that the Anchorage Fire Department has been working for years to remove excess dry timber on the hillside in Anchorage because the to get water up there to control the fire is extremely difficult, if not impossible, considering the size of the roads and all of that stuff. So I think we need to pay really close attention to who we're preventing from getting to the source of a fire, or the potential source of a fire, if there isn't even a fire, but they're just trying to clear the fuel before the fire actually happens.
Well, Representative Guttenberg, it was good of you to say it's not a simple bill. And so what we have right now is we've come to the end of the time we had scheduled for this bill for today. Representative Rauscher, we could keep this amendment in discussion for when we bring the bill back up, or we could take a vote on this amendment. I'll leave that up to you.
That would be fine. If we, we'll just come back.
Come back to it. Okay. And it sounds like there are a lot of questions, and so hopefully that'll give folks some time. But what it might also mean, because of the schedule for this week, is we may have to have an evening meeting on Wednesday to work through the amendments, and we'll keep in touch with everyone so that everyone knows. But it's looking like that might be the best opportunity, because with the operating budget, we might have some other evenings ahead of us coming up.
Appreciate your consideration, Madam Chair. Thanks.
Yes, and so we'll hang on to those. We'll keep Amendment Number 1 active for the next conversation. So thank you. Thank you, Representative Guttenberg. At this time, we're going to transition to our presentation on food security in Alaska. We have a great group of speakers here today, and folks I know have been coming into the room here with the Food Coalition fly-in. We have folks from food banks, from the Food Policy Council, from different state agencies all participating in this exciting event. Also on members' tables are a couple of Edible Alaska, a new publication about food security and food production in Alaska and small business development, and then Building Food Security, an executive summary, and I think that's going to be referred to in the presentation today. So I think our order, it looks like, if I have this correctly, is Mr. Ken Meter, then Dr. Gary Ferguson, and then Danny first. Okay, those are listed not in the order where they were. Okay, so the first presenter is going to be Mr. Danny Constantine. If you'd like to come forward, I'll give a little bit of a biography for the folks that are going to be presenting for us today. Mr. Constantine has more than 30 years of experience helping Alaska small economies grow and thrive. He served as the state executive director for the U.S. Department of Agriculture Alaska Farm Service Agency from 2009 to 2017. He now serves as a board member of the nonprofit Alaska Food Policy Council that works to build stronger food systems and healthier communities in our state. He's an avid backyard gardener and part of a commercial fishing family. Thank you.
Thanks. Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Danny Constantine. I'm a board member of the Alaska Food Policy Council, which is a coalition of Alaskans working together to create a healthier and more secure and more self-reliant state by improving our food system. And I just wanted to start by introducing that concept of a food system, which we use a lot. And it's a term used to describe all the ways that we're connected to food in a region. And it starts with where we get our food from, where it's grown, how it's stored or processed, distributed, eaten, who gets to eat it, and then how it's disposed of. It's kind of the whole cycle of food in a region. Sometimes people use the term food shed, like a watershed. This within our region, this is where how our food kind of fits into this ecosystem. When I was the executive director of the USDA Farm Service Agency, I worked with farmers all across Alaska, trying to help them become financially stable and financially successful. And as I thought about agriculture in Alaska and its importance, you know, you can look at the state seal. You can see there's a farmer on the state seal. You can look back to the role that agriculture has played in developing our state, from the Matanuska colony to all of the homesteaders. But kind of what made me think about what was really important was the impact that it has on our state, but how it has on our economy, that it has on our health, the health of our people and the health of our communities, on our security, and the role that it plays in kind of keeping all of our diverse cultures connected to their cultures. So it's kind of bigger than just, excuse me, the farmers that produce our food in Alaska. And so you look at our food system and you kind of say, is it working for us? Is it doing that? Is it creating jobs? Is it keeping us healthy? Is it keeping us secure? Is it keeping our cultures connected? And, you know, I'm not sure we can really answer that, that it's working that well. We're going to hear more from some other presenters today about really looking at some data to look at how well our food system is working for us under all of those criteria. So the Food Policy Council started looking at that, and the first thing that we did was we said, well, what would it look like if it was a strong food system, if it was doing all those things? And so we set some goals about where we might want to go if we were to Alaska was to have a strong food system. And I just wanted to go through those goals, and that help us kind of describe really what we're trying to achieve. Goal one that we set was that all Alaskans should have access to affordable, healthy, preferably local food. So when we talk about growing food in Alaska, we want to make sure that Alaskans get it, that it's available for everyone. It's not just at the farmer's market in South Anchorage for those people who can afford it. It's for all Alaskans. We want all Alaskans to have healthy food, whether it's in downtown Anchorage or in villages, which we also know some of the problems that villages experience. Our second goal was around businesses. We want to make sure Alaska has a healthy business environment for small businesses, large businesses that are in the food business, whether it's transportation, storage, distribution, restaurants, farmers, fishermen, all of those people involved in food should have a business environment and have a strong workforce, people who are trained to do these jobs that we're going to help, that would be there if we had a strong food system. Third goal is around making sure that the food is safe and protected as it's distributed. The fourth goal is around a sustainable food system, meaning we're going to be able to keep growing food and more food and enough food to feed Alaskans in the future. And the fifth goal says Alaskans should be engaged in our food system. And we thought that was important, too, that we talk about this, that people be aware, because that could lead to some solutions, too, if we engage the public around our food system. So that's where we want to go. I think the hard part about building a stronger food system is how do you do it? If we're going to change some policies, what are those policies? How should they be changed? And the Food Policy Council kind of took some early steps. We thought that procurement was one big driver. The consumers are already purchasing a lot of Alaska-grown products. They get it. They want to buy Alaska-grown. But are our institutions buying Alaska-grown? Is the state purchasing Alaska-grown? Are our school districts purchasing Alaska-grown? If we could get that engine of procurement working, then the private sector food producers would fill that gap from the supply side. So let's kind of pull it from the demand side. And so we were encouraging more programs in schools, and there was the Nutritional Alaska Foods in Schools program that helped schools purchase other farm to schools. We were very supportive of the product preference statute, the 7% statute, make sure that's enforced. So that was a big priority. We were involved in emergency planning. I think the more you get local communities to think about being prepared for the next emergency at the community level, I think that's a good step towards food security. For our goal about engaging Alaskans, we have sponsored 3 statewide conferences to bring people together, learn more, network, talk to each other. We also thought it was important to do that at the local community level, and so we facilitated some dialogue in 7 different communities in Nome, Fairbanks, Palmer, Bethel, Juneau, Homer, and Anchorage, where we kind of town halls where we brought people together to do that. We encouraged the state administration to form a kind of a work group so that state agencies who all have different responsibilities around food could communicate better, coordinate better, become more efficient, and that was created under Governor Parnell. There was a working group where agencies were working together. So I think those were some of our initial thoughts, but we're looking forward to working with you and other members of the legislature to think about other changes in policy that could build a stronger food system. The other thing we thought we really needed before we moved forward was to get an understanding of where we are now. Well, a lot of regions have done what they call a food assessment. So what does it look like? So we hired Ken Meter, who's an economist from Minnesota, who's done this for other regions and other states, to do a food assessment of Alaska. He traveled around the state, talked to a lot of people, and wrote a report, which committee members have, the executive summary. And Ken is here on the phone to talk about that report and what he found about our food system, particularly around the economics, how either jobs are created or not created with our food system. So I would just defer to Mr. Ken Meter to talk about the report.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Constantine before we get into the other one? Representative Birch.
Thank you. Through the chair. Does your presentation and the presentation, does this relate to any legislation that's in front of the body? Or is this just kind of a, I'm trying to connect the dots here. I mean, this is all nice information to know, but, you know, typically we have, or at least from my experience, we have a piece of legislation, then we take testimony as it relates to that legislation. Or is this just kind of a boutique interest type thing? Are you speaking to any particular legislation?
This is not in reference to any particular legislation, although there is legislation before the body that we are supportive of. A number of bills, I think, will go towards building a stronger food system. But I think the point that the presentation that I was making and the other presenters today are making is to get a good understanding of how our food system impacts Alaskans, how it impacts our economic development, how it impacts our health, how it impacts our food security and our
kind of just general interest kind of stuff.
Yeah, although I'm kind of hoping that the committee or other members of the legislature might be willing to work with us. So we're a nonprofit, kind of a think tank around food and around food policy, the Food Policy Council, towards maybe over the interim, so that maybe a next session with a group of legislators, we could come up with some legislation that might go a ways towards strengthening the food system that legislators could introduce next session.
Thank you.
Okay. With that, then we will go ahead, and if Mr. Meter is available. And members should have the PowerPoint to accompany his presentation.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm happy to be checking in from Minneapolis, where it's about the same temperature as Juneau, but a lot more snow today than you have. And I'm glad to have another chance to talk with several legislators about the results of the study we did, which is called Building Food Security in Alaska. As Danny mentioned, we think we've talked to several dozen people around the state of Alaska, both very direct interviews but also quite a bit of economic research, and I'm going to be racing very quickly through some of the highlights of that study, but you can certainly look at the study in greater depth if you want to learn more. The first picture on my first screen is just a reminder that for a lot of people who live in Alaska, food comes by airplane. This happens to be a Bush pilot coming back to the Juneau Airport from the island of Angoon. The next slide just is an example, or shows the studies that I've done around the country. I've been involved in 136 regional studies, some statewide studies in the brown states. This is a total of 40 states and 2 provinces in Canada and 3 tribes. But just to give you a sense of how widespread this discussion about food has been around the U.S. and my role in that. Next slide shows the Tena Hot Springs greenhouse. I'm going to show 3 slides. Just show some of the different approaches in Alaska to food security. This is Tena Hot Springs, tapping surplus heat from the hot springs there to raise vegetables that are sold to the people who come to visit the hot springs. The next slide is a traditional salmon drying image from Kotzebue from my trip in Alaska in 1982. And the next slide is Tim Meyer's farm in Bethel, showing the greenhouse that he's established to grow food, vegetables, and to sell them to people in Bethel above the Arctic Circle. The next slide I'd like to show just shows the population of Alaska from 1969 to the present, and you see it's gone from about 300,000 people to over 700,000. That's a total increase of 151%, so it's much more than doubled in the last 48 years. The next slide will take us to the blue line, which is the personal income in Alaska, which has gone from $10 billion to over 40. That's an increase of 304%, or really a quadrupling of personal income. And I think these two data points really pose an interesting question, because if you have a rising population with more money to spend, you would think that the economics of farming would be improving, because you have more mouths, more people with more money to spend to buy food, but we'll find that's not really the case. If you go to the next slide, the study we did showed that residents of the state buy about $2.1 billion of food every year. This is a very inexact number, but it's the best we can do with the data available. And we estimate that about $2 billion of that is sourced outside of Alaska. So every year, as Alaska buys food, about $2 billion leaves the state. And given the rising income and rising population, this was a challenge for us to look for ways that the state could retrieve some of those dollars and keep them in the state, keep them working for other purposes and other, even paying taxes within the state government. The next slide would be a contrast that the farmers in the state really only sell about $12 million of food products each year. So there's a really big gap between what farmers produce, the 700 and some farmers in the state, and the demand for food. So you have a very large gap that could be filled. The next slide shows the top farm products from the state from the Census of Agriculture in 2012. And as you see, although land is at a premium in Alaska, most of the land and most of the sales go to nursery crops, ornamentals that are for landscaping, but not for feeding people. The number two item is hay, which feeds cattle but doesn't feed humans. And vegetables is actually the third largest crop and the most significant crop for selling to humans. Quite a bit of production there that's very important, but it also does not do a lot to feed the population who live in the state. We estimate about $12 million, as I said before. The next slide shows the history of farm income in Alaska from 1969 to the present. The orange line on this chart shows all the money that all the farms in the state have earned by selling products since 1969. The maroon line shows how much it's cost those farmers to produce those products. And you notice in 2007, the costs of producing food and other commodities rose substantially, and it's been rising steadily even since then. And we have a strange situation where even though the returns that farmers are earning are staying steady, not increasing very much, the expenses have gone up. And that's a conundrum. I really can't answer why that's happening, but I think it's a really big challenge to the future of eating food from Alaska farms. If you subtract those expenses from the maroon line, from the orange line, the amount of money farmers earn selling products, you get the red line, which is the net cash income for farmers. And as you see, it's basically been declining pretty steadily since 2002. And it's been negative every year since 2005. So actually quite significant losses to farmers as they try to produce both food products and ornamentals for state residents. The next slide takes the same data and adjusts that for inflation, because the value of the dollar is now one-sixth the value it had when that previous chart was started. This is just the same data adjusted for inflation, and when you look at those terms, you see that there's actually quite a bit more money earned in the 1970s when the value of the dollar was higher. The earnings in 1997 and 2001 look a little bit higher, but the losses are still the same since 2005.
Mr. Meader, we have a question for you.
I'm sorry?
A question? Representative Parrish.
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Did I hear you correctly that you don't know what to attribute the enormous spike in expenses for farmers to in 2007?
Well, I really don't, and I think it's just mostly because the data I have shows us what farmers are spending their money on, and a lot of this is increased labor costs, but I don't think I have the time or the resources to really answer that question very adequately. I think my assumption is that farmers have their land, they have their operations, and they often have to have some kind of job off the farm in order to pay for the cost of that operation. And so essentially, if you have a farm going on and you may not be making it very well, even though your expenses keep rising, you keep selling what you can on the farm and make up for that income with an off-farm job. But I don't feel like I know the answer to that question very reliably.
Thank you.
Please continue.
Sure, I will do that. I guess there's one other answer I can give to that same question, too, which is the numbers you see in the range 1991 to 1990 to 2003, where there's a peak in the orange line. Some of that peak is also due to the fact that the state of Alaska started counting what I would consider non-farm items as part of agricultural income. And when that stopped in 2003, we see the income for farmers leveling off. And so in a sense, you could say the positive income in that era from 1994 to 2003 is more of a statistical question more than a reality for farmers. And if you take that bump out, you see a pretty steady decline since 1989 to the present. The slide here that I have, which would show that farmers are making $33 million less farming today than they were in 1969, and that altogether since 1989, farmers have spent $119 million more raising crops and livestock than they got from the market. So these are sort of severe questions for the future of agriculture, especially when there are so many hundreds of thousands of people to feed and so much a tradition of agriculture in the state of Alaska in the past.
We have another question from Representative Rauscher.
Of course.
Yes, through the chair. Thank you very much. You had made a statement that between 91 and 2003, was when the sale of non-farm items stop. What are examples of those items?
Well, from my understanding from the staff at the Agricultural Division, there was a time when some of the farmed seafood products were considered agriculture. And so there was a statistical move to basically claim those as part of agriculture. But over time, that was disallowed because it really didn't conform with federal practices. And so you have those higher numbers of sales essentially because of an accounting shift. And when we go back to, in about 2003, we go back to the more standard accounting system, and you see that the cash receipts are pretty much steady in adjusted dollars since then from 2003 to 2016.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. We have another question from Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And through the Chair, The 2.1 billion that you had in a previous slide showing how much Alaskans spend on food, was that just agricultural products, or is that also with seafood and everything else? Because it looked like Alaska had about 100 million that we provide for ourselves. Is that just strictly farmed products, agricultural products?
Yeah, I mean, I think, again, the numbers are not real clear here, because I to get this number, I use an average for the western states of the U.S., and, of course, the cost of food is higher in Alaska than it is in most western states, but also you have more people depending on subsistence or some other personal use gathering of wild foods, and so it's not a very accurate number, and it's not in the sense that I can't prove it's exactly $2.1 and $2 billion, but... And I can't really say that I can prove there's $100 million of trade from Alaska farms to Alaska consumers. The data I have would show the direct sales from farmers right to household customers, and that's about $2.2 million in 2012. So that's all the hard data I would have to show how much food is moving directly from farms to household customers. That would not include food that goes to a grocery store, or food that is, you know, processed on the way to an Alaska consumer. So it's a very inadequate total measure. But we're really seeing quite a small flow of food from Alaska farms to Alaska consumers, and not a lot of food processing on the state either.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, please continue.
Okay. I will continue the next slide, which really addresses the SNAP benefits coming into the state of Alaska. And this is another humbling number. You'll notice in the red line is the same red line you saw before, but it looks much shallower because the scale has changed. The orange line here is the amount of federal payments coming in to support farmers, which have been rising in the last few years, commensurate with the decline in farm income. But I think the really startling story here is that low-income people receiving SNAP benefits are, you know, got up to $200 million of SNAP benefits in 2011, and that's fallen off to $160 million, but that's still 13 times the amount of food that farmers sell. So the number one source of food in the state of Alaska is often, or money for food, is often SNAP benefits. And in a way, you could argue that public subsidies from the federal government are more important than feeding Alaskans than farmers are themselves. And that's, again, a challenge, I think, for the longevity and the health of people who live in the state. The next slide would add to that the concern that the state spends about $450 million every year to cover the medical costs of diabetes and related conditions, another flow of money leaving Alaska every year. And this, of course, is tied not only to eating improper foods, but also improper exercise and another reason to think about having more Alaskans more closely connected to a source for very healthy food. We also did a calculation on the next slide with the ear of corn, which shows that if every person in the state were to buy $5 of food directly from some farm in the state, and of course those farms don't really exist now, so this is a very hypothetical calculation, but if that could be done, farms that earn $193 million of income, which is 16 times the current cash receipts. So some fairly specific changes like that could make a very large difference in terms of farm income. The state of Alaska took our suggestion and started a buy $5 challenge last year. And the next slide shows the food retailers that participated in that. Car Safeway won an award for their displays around the state, and Walmart came in second. But we had very good collaboration from the Alaska Farm Bureau, from these retailers, from farmers, and several producers said that they really increased their sales and their reach in selling food because of that challenge. I think that, you know, continuing the Alaska Grown Challenge could make a really big impact in just publicizing to Alaska residents why it would be in their interest to buy more food from local farmers. The next slide with the gourd shows that one of every three farms in the state does sell direct to customers, and that ranks Alaska up with states like Vermont and New Hampshire as one of the top states in the nation for how many farms reach out directly to their customers. We also did a very quick calculation. Again, this is not gospel, but it's an interesting indication of how much land would be required to provide all of Alaska's demand for a few select vegetables that are easy to grow in Alaska. 4,700 acres for potatoes, 200 for carrots, 200 for cabbage, 600 for lettuce. And certainly the state, even though it's given up much of its best land for urban development, it does have land like this that's suitable for farming. And it certainly has this land if it can be developed and if new farmers can be brought on and if the fertility can be improved and so on. And then finally, I just wanted to mention very quickly a project we did in South Carolina, which ironically is importing almost as much food as Alaska does. Even though they have four growing seasons, we did a study of their food system in 2013. And the way we approached that was to say you need a real whole web of facilities. We called it the food web, where you have aggregation points like one exists in Charleston, but you also have places on farms where farms have the infrastructure to wash food safely, to package it safely, to get it on pallets, to load it for stores, or to sell it to individual household customers. And we think a model like that would work very well in Alaska as well. The next slide shows a packing barn that a farm in Wisconsin has built here. It's a very good example of a farm that's built the infrastructure to make local food trade much more efficient, all the way from these boxes back to a very small microvan that can convey that to the buyers. And I think the general point I would make in my final slide is really that I think the key role of public investment, in addition to publicizing the need to buy food from Alaska farms, but also to build infrastructure that creates community efficiencies, because we've invested so heavily on having good auto transport, good air transport, so food can travel very rapidly from long distances, but it has trouble going the short distances within the state. And we need to build warehouses, as Danny said, an entire system of relationships that will convey food from local farms to local consumers. And I would think that would be a very good role for the state to take on. My final slide just shows my contact information. If you have any reason to get a hold of me, you can catch me through that email address. And all of our studies are on the website, and that phone number will work for finding me as well. Thank you very much for this time and attention.
Thank you, Mr. Meader. We have a question from Representative Birch.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I'm looking at your net cash income for farmers 1969 through 2016, and it appears that the industry in Alaska, at least in that year, lost about 25 or maybe $30 million on $40 million worth of sales and or cash receipts. It looks like by the time you take into account. What would you have the state of Alaska do to mitigate this? And I can see on that very same slide, in 2000, you were $20 million to the good. But here, more currently, it looks like the farming industry in Alaska has lost $30 million on $40 million worth of sales. What would you have the state of Alaska do?
Well, I think my answer is really what I said at the very end of my presentation, which is that I think creating some infrastructure, food caches in rural areas, warehouses, and with freezer and cooler space, so that it becomes more efficient to get food from farms to customers in the state, advertising the need for consumers to buy food and keep the money in the state, supporting new farms. So you have people with the skills of agriculture. In 1950, Alaska had quite a few folks who really were skilled in agriculture. Now that those numbers are quite a bit declined. But I think that it really has to build the support system around agriculture to make it feasible for people to make a better livelihood than they currently are making.
Follow up? Mm-hmm. Yeah, just looking at the raw numbers, it appears to me like you need to double your receipts to at least break even. And, at least I'm in Anchorage, I'm in an urban area, but, it seems like most people that I know, they shop at Costco, they shop at Walmart, in an urban area, you kind of shop where the groceries show up. through the port of Alaska, I guess it is now. But I don't know. I appreciate fresh carrots as much as the next guy, but it just looks like you got a huge hole here to dig out of looking at the numbers there. And I'm just trying to figure out, you know, short of just a straight up subsidy, you know, what exactly you're looking for. And I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
And Mr. Meader, I don't know if you looked at the number of new farms during that time, but, you know, some of that, what's represented by the, you know, sort of the net line there, it's really cost intensive to start a new farm, and we've had a lot of growth in that industry in those more recent years. But, of course, they'd be really upside down financially, because if they had to make any heavy equipment purchases or land purchases, relative to the amount of income they could bring as they started up, that would put them upside down like that. Did you evaluate anything like that?
Well, not in any great detail. What you say is totally accurate in my experience, but I think I have a limited experience of that question. I would say that, just to respond further to the question, that one of the dilemmas Alaska farmers have is that as farmers have moved towards importing more inputs, when the oil often even comes from out of the state, because it's been pumped in Alaska but goes down to Seattle for refining and comes back to the state, when people are buying fertilizers from outside. Alaska has the real challenge, because all the inputs essentially have to be brought in from the from outside, and that adds cost to the farming. As the cost of living goes up, that means it's more expensive for labor and so on. And I think, you know, some of the refinements that could be to use some of the waste food that manufacturers and hotel, the tourist industry creates, to create more fertility, to have that fertility be homegrown rather than purchasing chemicals from outside, to have an infrastructure that's really more based on materials that can be harvested and grown inside the state instead of importing. As you buy inputs, but also often having to spend quite a bit in transportation costs to get it to market. So I think there are ways. Alaska historically has had a fairly interesting cattle and dairy and vegetable industries, and it can be done. In some ways, it's become less economical precisely because we've invested in infrastructure that made it so easy to get food to a store, but didn't make it easy to get food from a farm to a consumer.
Any other questions for Mr. Meader? Okay, thank you for your presentation today. Really appreciate it. And the next presenter is going to be Dr. Gary Ferguson, who is here in person or online? Online as well. And his presentation is in here. And I will say, just in the broader context, I mean, thinking of our responsibility with jurisdiction over Department of Natural Resources, you know, one of the things that we spend a lot of time on is Division of Oil and Gas, quite a bit of time on Division of Mining, you know, and the associated issues. But we do have the Division of Lands, Mine, and Water, and we do have Division of Agriculture. And those are divisions that have generally gotten a lot less attention. And so one of the things that we've been trying to do in the last couple of years is look at the other opportunities, you know, relative to that type of resource development. And as we think about land management and the vast areas we have available, in fact, that was one of the letters we wrote last year as a committee to the federal government to try and increase access. So I think, you know, just these are issues that perhaps we haven't paid close enough attention to, but what really stands out at this time to me is the $2 billion opportunity for our economy. And so that's what's prompted us to want to have these hearings, just to respond to a bit of Representative Birch's concern. Dr. Ferguson, can you hear us?
Yes, I can.
Okay, it looks like you are up and ready to go. And if you could just say when to change the slide, and we'll help you out with that. If you put yourself on the record and what organization you're with.
So I'm Dr. Gary Ferguson. I am currently a Healthy Communities Consultant, and I've had background and experience working in the tribal health system the last 16 years, and also have in the past served on the Alaska Food Policy Council, and have been working on food and nutrition security issues for many years, primarily in the Alaska tribal health system, but across the state. and I'm ready to jump into my presentation, and I will do my best to get to these slides. I wanted to paint the portrait, the first slide looking at a river system, and a lot of my work has been around addressing the social, economic, cultural, and environmental factors that contribute to health and well-being. And the next slide shows the social determinants of health and really having to move upstream to really stem the tide of some of these long-term issues that we've had to prevent chronic disease. And nutrition's a really important part of that as we address food and food systems and making sure we have vibrant local food economies and also traditional foods, which I'll focus in on why that's been so important for my career. The next slide shows the domains of health influence, and I'm also a clinician, and that's a really important part of health care and keeping communities whole is to have really great public health and clinics. But at the same time, when you look at clinical care, it's only about 20% of the domain of health influence, and health behaviors are about 30%. So, you know, and eating is a part of that, like what we eat, what we have available around us so that we can make healthy choices. And then also the social and economic determinants of, you know, we know that education, employment are key indicators and also environment. But food and having healthy food available is really important as you look at health and well-being in communities. The next slide looks at Maslow's hierarchy, which is a theoretical model looking at as we address the basic needs, food, safety, security, that communities and individuals can be actualized. And in this case, this is the Blackfoot Nation model, which Maslow studied with the Blackfoot Nation as a part of his understanding of the way that people evolve to being healthy. And the First Nations model is really an interesting one where it's not just about individual actualization, but it's about cultural perpetuity, and food is at the basis of that, healthy foods and foods locally available. Next slide is Alaska Magazine in the early 2000s, the store outside their door looking at subsistence lifestyles and the importance of these foods to our communities. And it's not just about addressing food security by shipping a bunch of food into villages. It's also about looking at how do we value these local and traditional foods. And not only are they important for nutrition, but they're also important on cultural levels and bringing families together and the sharing of traditions and cultures. The next slide focuses in on the decline in traditional foods. In this case, this is a study looking at traditional food marine intake and vitamin D levels. So historically, Alaskan Native people had very high levels of vitamin D, which are, you know, marine food intake primarily. And this study showed that historically through the blood bank at the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium that we've had a consistent decline because of the change to a more Western diet and giving up of some of these important traditional foods. Next slide shows that our traditional foods, Alaskan traditional foods, this is a study in the Norton Sound region looking at Yupik and Inupiat population showing that traditional foods such as seal oil and salmon improved pre-diabetes and actually prevented diabetes and also showed that folks who ate traditional diets had less cardiovascular disease. Next study, the next slide talks about the fact that many Alaska Native people are actually hardwired for these traditional foods and may not do so well with Western foods such as grains and sugar and carbohydrates. Our traditional diets primarily high fat, high protein, and low carbohydrate. And this is the congenital sucrase isomaltase deficiency, which upwards to 10% of the Inuit population, the Inuit population, are many of our Alaska Native people don't do well with carbohydrates. And so our traditional foods truly are good medicine for the people that we've evolved our genes to have these foods be a part of our diets. And many of us don't do well when we shift to a more Western diet. Next slide is just talking about health costs and the fact that chronic disease is a very expensive hit on the healthcare system. And when we look at obesity and some of our chronic diseases that are preventable by eating a healthy diet, including traditional foods, we end up with cost savings to our healthcare systems. Next slide just talks about why food is medicine, and Hippocrates, considered the father of medicine, stated it well early on, that food is truly medicine, and our medicine should be our first medicine should be our food. Next, the slide talks about the Store Outside Your Door program, which I have been honored to help co-produce over the years when I worked at Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium and working with all of the many tribes and tribal health organizations to capture how to hunt, fish, gather, and grow food in your community. And there's many resources on showing how resilient communities can be when they focus on the store outside their door versus the store that's locally available and often doesn't have healthy, nutrient-dense foods available on the store shelves. Next slide just shows us picking the beach. For those of you who are beach gatherers, the Podarki, it's a traditional food I grew up on. I'm from Sandpoint in Shumgin Islands, and so we have a nice webisode showing you how to harvest off the beach and make a Podarki salad. Next slide is showing some of the best practices in incorporating traditional foods into local health systems. In this case, we're in Kotzebue at the Sigaluk, and the amazing work being done there around having traditional foods such as caribou and seal and other foods that can go into the facility there serving elders. And often there have been barriers, and we've been working through the barriers that perhaps sometimes folks look at from a USDA or FDA perspective. And it's just a really wonderful way of serving elders foods that not only are nutrient-dense to help them with feeling good, but also have cultural connections and are truly comfort foods for them. Next slide is just talking about that our taste preferences start young, and maybe even in the womb, what mom eats we crave later in life, and our first foods are really important. Next slide is a slide from Nulukatak. This is Patty Kaniurak and her boy Connor, and she's feeding him mikiak, a traditional food of the north with whey. It's a fermented whale product and incredibly iron-rich and nutrient-dense, and getting him set right as he starts his life. And ideally, we'll have a preference for these incredibly nutrient-dense local foods. Next slide is just, this is from Metlakatla. This is kawash, which is a traditional food from Metlakatla, which is, the next slide shows Naomi and her daughter Sierra having this traditional food as a teething way to teethe Sierra, and also to help her develop a taste for this nutrient-dense food. And salmon is very rich in vitamin D and calcium, and it's an amazing source of nutrition. And getting kids hardwired for these foods is really important. Just going to page through the next slides. This is fireweed. Next slide shows fireweed in the spring, which isn't far off in some of our southern communities in Alaska. Nutrient-dense green, traditionally harvested. Next slide shows the nutrient density from the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium book on traditional foods, that one cup of fireweed leaves or shoots is more than what you need of vitamin A for the day, and vitamin C is a very great source in fiber. And our studies have shown that our greens in all of the plants in Alaska, the harsher the environment, the more nutrient-dense these foods become, because of having to exist in a harsh environment, they form antioxidants, which also benefit us. So incredible sources. Next slide shows Delia Stone up in Point Hope picking. The next slide is quaggach, which is the sourdough. Wonderful nutrient-dense greens. And, you know, often people don't realize that there are so many foods that are in the landscape that we can live off of, and our ancestors have thrived nutritionally because of being connected to the land, and making sure these foods are available for the next generation is really important. Next slide is a slide I love to show at health presentations, because one of the challenges in our young people and also some of our elders is iron deficiency anemia. And in fact, in our Head Start program statewide, that's it's a big issue. So this is a slide showing 3-ounce portion of seal is equal to about 2 portions of caribou or reindeer. And you got to eat 6 hamburgers to get that same amount of iron in that 3-ounce portion of seal. And if you go to the next slide, that's how many hot dogs that you would have to eat. And that would be 56 hot dogs to equal 1 3-ounce portion of seal meat as far as iron is concerned. And just an anecdote, I showed a picture of the Mikiak, the whale, and whale is approximately 2 times the amount of iron than seal. So, you know, these incredibly nutrient-dense foods are important to our people and also from a health promotion disease prevention standpoint. Next slide shows some of our wonderful berries. These are the moss berries, so blackberries, some blueberries. And the next slide just shows that our antioxidant value of those, this is the ORAC, which is a measure of antioxidant activity, shows that our traditional berries harvested in Alaska are sometimes 3, 4, 5, 6 times as high in antioxidants than commercially harvested berries, which we know are also very good for us. Next slide shows the interest from CDC and NIH showing that our traditional foods are really important for the future of indigenous peoples as we look at chronic disease prevention and health promotion. And the next slide shows for my home region some of the work that Aleutian Pueblo Islands Association has done to address traditional foods in Head Start facilities. This is Kakamegak, which is our traditional foods that we eat in the Aleutian and Pueblo Island region. And the next slide is what some communities are doing to really help them understand the value of traditional foods and the importance of passing that on to our next generations. And this is an Igigig, which I haven't seen the results of it, but they did a 6-week traditional food challenge as a health experiment and measured biometrics and ways of weight and blood pressure and blood sugar to heart rate to see how these traditional foods really impacted their health after 6 weeks. Next slide is from APCA, and this is a culture camp, and we've got culture camps all over the state every year and helping our next generations be connected to their food system and to how to live off the land. And, of course, it's a great way to get physical activity as well and be connected to your culture and elders. And my final slide is a quote from Dr. Rita Blumenstein, who has been a great supporter of our work with traditional foods and traditional medicines. And she says, "We are free to be who we are, to create our own life out of our past and out of the present. We are our ancestors. When we heal ourselves, we also heal our ancestors, our grandmothers, our grandfathers, and our children. When we heal ourselves, we heal Mother Earth." And very well spoken elder who continues to give to the community. And as we address food and security, helping these next generations grow up healthy and sound, and really I think in the end we'll save our state a lot of money and effort at trying to address chronic diseases once they've fully manifested versus preventing them with healthy foods in the first place. Thank you very much for allowing me to present.
Thank you, Dr. Ferguson. Really, really appreciate your presentation. And I apologize because I didn't read your bio before we got the presentation started, so I hope members will look at that to learn a little bit more about you. But also just really think that your presentation highlights the challenge that we have in the legislature and in public policy where we tend to work in silos. But, you know, from the natural resource perspective, it's clear that, you know, when we're making decisions about land management and access, you know, we should also be thinking about, you know, the foods that people will have access to as a result of that. You know, you added so much information about the healthcare costs, but, you know, of course, that's why we need to have these conversations, because the kind of decisions we're making about land access or resource management are in turn impacting our healthcare system and healthcare costs. And so I hope that's something that we can sort of take away from these presentations today, and why we're wanting to have the conversation about statewide planning and statewide thinking about a food system. So just a couple of comments from me. Any questions for Dr. Ferguson? Okay, we're not seeing any questions for you this afternoon. Thank you so much again for your for joining us this afternoon. I really appreciate the presentation. I don't know if you have any closing comments you'd like to leave us with.
So as far as, you know, the work that's being done, I really feel like, and I think that comment that you made about protecting food systems when we look at baseline environmental impact statements and looking at communities and resource development, I think having really great baseline surveys of traditional foods, where folks get their foods from, I think is going to be a really important part of protecting and making sure that, you know, we have healthy, vital food systems. And I feel like it's a spectrum. A lot of my work has been how do we live off the land and be vibrant people, and how do we connect to the understanding that our ancestors had of these important foods, and the fact that, you know, Elder Howard Luke from the interior of Alaska talks about if we don't stay connected to our food system and these important foods that are truly medicine, that they'll go away. That is it's a form of disrespect. So it's like this environmental stewardship is actually a cultural value. And so I think your point is well taken of just really making sure that as we develop and provide local economies with resource development, that we also make sure we protect these important traditional foods. And also, you know, Mr. Meter's comments about, you know, some of the fertile land areas that we can grow as well. So we also incorporate that piece into our thinking. So thank you again for the time to present and share this information.
Thank you. Really appreciate it. And before we go into our last presentation, Mr. Constantine, do you have any closing remarks or anything?
No, I just look forward to working with the committee on some options for some policy changes that would strengthen our food system over the interim.
And we hope to work with some folks, and we've talked about doing a task force or a caucus, and so we have a couple of ideas, working groups, and so we will definitely be continuing that conversation, and really appreciate your presence today. Also, again, just to announce that those folks are in town, the co-chair will be buying a healthy snack for the members for our meeting on Wednesday. Carrots. There we go. Alaska grown carrots. I believe there are some events, though, while the Food Coalition is in town, and I hope folks will take a look at their calendar and try to attend those.
There's a lunch and learn tomorrow, and then they're going to participate in a bill signing of our Fellow Resource Bill tomorrow as well.
Okay, and I'll just quickly announce that for the record that there's a lunch and learn tomorrow on SNAP programs in Alaska, and then a bill signing for Representative Tallarico's bill to address food waste and make it easier to make donations. Okay. Thank you so much. Our last presentation for today is from our friends at the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission. I see Ms. Forrester is here as well. I don't know if you're coming up or just Mr. French.
Only if there's hard questions.
Okay, I'll pop up. Thank you, Madam Chair, yes. And forgive me for the time disruption. I hope it wasn't too much of a problem. I thought we were going second, and so I was a few minutes late.
Oh, not at all. Nope, no problem at all. Okay.
And how much time do we have?
Just until the end, so we have about 35 minutes.
Okay, excellent. Great. I brought four slides to just give you an update as to what the latest is on the North Slope, and I'll just start with that one. That's the latest production numbers. You can see that's a slide you've seen 100 times over the past. Oh, and I'll just introduce myself. I'm Hollis French, here with AOGCC. And we just wanted to bring you the latest numbers we have from our shop about what's happening with production and drilling and so forth. So there's the production. This is workover activities. You can see the 2017 numbers were just assembled by our statisticians recently and presented to us. You can see that it's the same trend that we've been on for the last few years. Historically, not out of no aberration. Historically, we just wanted to show you what we're looking at.
Any questions on that?
Yes,
Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Commissioner French, this basically reflects. In the lay sense, which is the sense I sometimes operate by, this reflects an effort to double down and get more of the resource out of the ground. And it reflects, in a sense, resources available and economic strength. And do I have that right?
You know, I would be cautious personally about commenting on what it means.
Okay.
I want to give you the numbers so you can look at those numbers and draw your own conclusions. We see, a certain number of workovers that took place last year. And just for the clarification, workovers are something short of drilling a well. They're usually repair on a well. There's some kind of a problem downhole that needs to be fixed, some kind of acidization, things along those lines, downhole well work that are short of drilling a new well. So, that's the result right there. And we just want you to have the same information we have.
Representative Parrish. and then Birch.
Thank you. So I see the most active year was in 2009, but I don't see any connection between these and a dollar value for the workover activities. Is it just the number of instances? Looks like, you know, anywhere from between about 650 to the high of just under 1,800 in 2009, but is there a way to get the average expense of each of those, and would that be useful?
The cost per job? Through the chair, Representative Parrish, you mean the cost per workover, the cost per job? I don't have access to that number. No, they don't submit billing receipts to us. We just permit the actual work, and then out it goes to the field, if that answers your question.
Yes, thank you.
Representative Birch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Commissioner. I just was looking at the, you know, we've seen for the last 3 years, we've seen an uptick in production, and, you know, that's certainly good news for Alaskans. Do you see this as a contributor to that? I mean, is this I'm kind of looking at the dark green portion of the bars there that relates to enhancements. So when you say, you know, it's existing wells workover, are they working magic with the wells to produce more oil? I mean, there's clearly more oil being produced. Instead of a decline, we've actually got an uptick, which is remarkable in my view. But is that represented here in what we're seeing in these activities?
Through the chair, Representative Birch, you know, I think the way to look at this is to say, if you don't do this work, the decline is going to be a lot worse.
There's
you
no
know,
decline, though.
Well, no. Through the chair, Representative Birch, you're absolutely right. Without this work, things get worse. The uptick in production is due to a number of factors, and certainly the work you saw back in 2014 and 2015 has something to do with that. These are wells that have been stimulated, they've been repaired, they've been operated on to work better, and we're seeing the results.
So that investment has actually had a material difference and impact, positive impact on production than what you can.
Through the chair, Representative Birch, I think the short answer is yes.
Okay, great. That's good news. Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay.
We also have slides on exploration wells and production wells, but I'm having a hard time finding them. Maybe Mr. your committee aide can give me a hand here. This is an always a popular category of exploration wells. You can see it's always a relatively low number compared to other wells, but as a sort of a harbinger of the future, we knew you'd be interested in that. And finally, we have a slide on just regular, the drilling of what I would call regular wells. And it is, that's workovers. There we go. And these are, you know, the drilling of, you know, what I would call a normal well, a non-exploration well, a well that's being drilled either at Prudhoe or Kerr Park or in a known field in a known location, a so-called development well. And you can see it's remarkably steady, really, over the years.
Can we go back to the previous slide just for a moment?
Let me see if I can find it. Nope.
Okay, that was that one.
Yep.
Okay, and just so that we give folks a moment to just study that and see if there are any questions, because it seems to me it's all the operators down the side, so that's an interesting.
It takes a minute to orient yourself.
Bit
correct.
Of information. Representative Birch has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I had a question or two in that slide as well. You know, there's been a lot said about oil tax credits, and the I think we have $1 billion worth of. Liability yet on paying those down, but would this slide and some of those wells, would they be represented in the investment that the state of Alaska has made, or actually that the industry has made? And I think I went to a RDC or Alliance presentation last year, and they had a Colville River. It had some very promising results, kind of Kalis, Smith Bay, and so forth. Is that represented in what we're looking at here?
Through the chair, Representative Birch, if the well has actually been drilled, then the short answer, yes. The Smith Bay wells, the Nanushuk wells, the wells that are being drilled out in the NPRA, especially back in 13, 14, 15, you see those represented. Kalis is the gold color, and I think you can see their wells in 2014, 15, 2014 and 2015.
Okay, thank you.
Madam Chair.
Representative Parrish.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So when we're looking at this slide here, I notice at the bottom it says total wells and well branches drilled and completed, suspended, or abandoned since 2003. Do you know what proportion of these would be abandoned wells?
Through the chair, Representative Parrish, I can't tell you off the top of my head, but it's frequently the case that a exploration well is drilled, it's analyzed, and then it's plugged and abandoned shortly thereafter, because there's no immediate plan to come back and re-enter that wellbore and do something with it. And so it seems counterintuitive to a layperson that you would abandon a well you just drilled, but it happens in the industry with some regularity.
Thank you.
And Commissioner French, just looking at the number of operators here, so these ones are all in active exploration work, not just that they are the leasee?
Well, to the chair, to the chair, these are wells that are actually drilled. So company may be leasing property, they may be expanding, they may be making plans, they may be announcing plans. But until they actually put a drill bit in the earth and drill the well, we of course don't count it.
Got it. Any other questions on this slide? And what was throwing me off is there's also one in our packet that's looks somewhat similar, but it's not statewide. It's just the Arctic Slope oil and gas exploration one. So folks have both of those.
Very good. Thank you. Now, if I could, I'm going to turn to and giving you an update on our bonding, our effort to update our bonding practices and to present an idea that we want you to consider either this year or in a future year. And I want to start with a quote, and it's a quote from a publication that's called Risks of Acquiring Aging Oil Fields. And it was published in the Rocky Mountain Mineral Law Foundation. I think it was presented at a conference for natural resource lawyers. And the quote is a little bit dark, but I'll just read it to you. I guess I sort of imaginatively hear, you all seen the movie The Matrix? I hear one of the agents saying this in kind of a dark voice, right? But I'm not going to do that, but you can imagine me saying it. As sure as death is the great certainty of life, so too is plugging the great certainty of petroleum development. Every well will, at some future point unknown, cease to produce in paying quantities and require plugging. In transactions involving aging oil field properties, both the seller and the purchaser must understand and appreciate their respective risk of plugging liability. So to you, I want to make you aware of what the size of the liability is. How many wells are there in Alaska that we're talking about? In Alaska, there's about 5,200 wells. Most are oil producers. Some are injectors, either of gas or water or a thing called miscible injectant to help sweep the reservoir, and a few are disposal wells. And while a 5,000-plus may seem like a large number, and it is a large number, keep in mind that Louisiana has something like 200,000 wells, and Texas has something like 500,000 wells. So while Alaska may someday have that number, we've got a long way to go, but we want to stay on top of this issue from the get-go. Our agency, AOGCC, holds bonds for the purpose of making sure the operator of the lease plugs and abandons their wells when they're finished. We've begun the process of updating our bonding practices. We brought this attention to you last year. We pointed out then that our regulations say that a bond for a single well must not be less than $100,000 and not less than $200,000 for a blanket bond covering all of the state for an operator. In practice, the agency has historically required no more than those amounts, $100,000 for the first well and $200,000 for all subsequent wells. Many people are surprised to learn that all of BP's wells on the North Slope, of which there are about 1,900, are covered by a $200,000 bond. The same is true of ConocoPhillips.
Could you say those numbers again, please? I was taking notes.
BP has just north of 1,900 wells, and so does ConocoPhillips. They're both about the same, 1,900 wells, give or take a few more. The headline from last year's hearings said paltry bonding for oil operators puts Alaska at risk, and we think that pretty well sums it up. Over the summer, the agency held a workshop to discuss the issue with industry and solicited their input directly and through written submissions. As we mentioned last year, we don't believe we need any statutory authority to take action. And indeed, the comments we received after the workshop from both AOGA and ConocoPhillips said the same thing. We don't need a new law. We have the authority we need to take action. And keep in mind, we're not the only holders of bonds in the state. The Department of Natural Resources also holds bonds for something called dismantlement, removal, and rehabilitation, or DR&R, monies that are held to remove surface improvements like VSMs, pipelines, tanks, facilities, and so forth. Now, the Commission has not arrived at a cookbook answer for this bonding effort. Earlier in this year, in 2018, we sent a letter to every operator in the state requiring them to give us their estimates of what it would cost to properly plug and abandon their wells, and those reports are due this Wednesday. Also informing our effort was the bankruptcy of a company called Aurora Gas, which is a small outfit, tiny operator, 19 gas wells, all of them on the west side of Cook Inlet. And while we've seen here in Alaska oil companies go bankrupt in the past, this one was different in that no one stepped forward to buy all of Aurora Gas's assets. Indeed, of the 19 wells they had when they went into bankruptcy, only the 6 best producing wells were acquired by a new company called Aurora Exploration. And don't be confused. Even while those names seem very similar, they are distinct legal entities. The agency spent a lot of time in bankruptcy court watching this fall, and we learned a lot about that process by attending the hearings. But back to the wells. We started off with 19. 6 were bought by the new company. That leaves 13 wells. 10 of them are on land owned by SERI. And that actually turns out to be a pretty big break for the state of Alaska, because for our purposes, if the operator disappears, we look to the landowner by our regulations for following through on plugging and abandoning that well. So SERI has 10 sort of dead wells they're going to have to pay eventually to plug and abandon. The other 3 wells are going to fall on the Department of Natural Resources, and I have a feeling sometime in the future, next year, they're going to come and say we need some money to make these wells safe and to plug and abandon them. How much was that going to cost? We held a hearing this fall in order to get a better handle on what it costs to plug and abandon a well. There's really no simple answer. The first question you ask is, well, where is the well located? Is it on the North Slope? Is it in Cook Inlet? Is it on the road system? Is it not on the road system? We dealt with a company this summer that had a grand total of 2 wells, and both of them were kind of oddballs. One was on the west side of Cook Inlet, over by the mouth of the Kustatan River. The other one was on the North Kenai, but it was off the road system. They have to build a snow road to get to that well to take care of it. And keep in mind that for bonding purposes, the question is really not, what is it going to cost you, Mr. Operator, to do this work? Because the bond is in place if they fail to do their obligation. The bond is in place as if the state has to step in and do the work. And so we have to sort of figure out what amount of money do we need to hold as security in case we get handed this job. Our best estimate for plugging and abandoning the wells on the west side of Cook Inlet, off the road system, is around $600,000 each. So all of this information brings me to the impetus for this hearing. As we've been working on this issue, it's come to our attention that in at least 2 jurisdictions, in California and in Kansas, the regulating authority there is armed with statutes that allow it to pursue former operators for plugging and abandonment costs in the event that a current operator is financially unable to do so. The statutes do not get much use. They're there as a form of a backstop. One high-profile case in California involved an oil platform in Santa Barbara. The current operator went bankrupt, and potentially leaving the state of California on the hook for millions of dollars of costs. Their prior operator law allowed them to enter into negotiations with Exxon, who had operated the platform when the law went into effect, and the state has reached a settlement with them, and I think to the good of the taxpayers of California. The language of California's law is pretty simple. It says this: the current operator, as determined by the records of the supervisor, of a deserted well that produced oil, gas, or other hydrocarbons, or was used for injection is responsible for the proper plugging and abandonment of the well or the decommissioning. If the supervisor determines that the current operator does not have the financial resources to fully cover the cost, the immediately preceding operator shall be responsible for the cost of plugging and abandoning the well. And the supervisor may continue to look seriatim one after another at previous operators until an operator is found that the supervisor determines has the financial resources to cover the cost of plugging and abandonment. That's the California law, and I'll close with the Kansas law, which is a lot more straightforward. It just says, for the purposes of this section, a person who is legally responsible for the proper care and control of an abandoned well shall include, but is not limited to, one or more of the following: the current or last operator of the lease upon which such a well is located. So they just say current or last. So those are two approaches, either one to keep going back in time until you find someone who can afford to P&A the wells, or just the last operator. But I think both of those capture a concept, which is this is an enormous liability, it's not going to go away soon, and going back to the beginning quote, in transactions when an aging oil field is sold, I think both sides know they you know, there's something at risk here. It may not be black and white, but there's something at risk for all that liability. And so that's basically my presentation. Commissioner Forstner has reviewed this, and so we're here to answer any questions you might have about the idea or other topics.
Okay, great. And we have had a few questions lined up here as you were going through, but wanted to hold them till the end so you could get through that.
Thank you.
Representative Johnson, then Rauscher, then Josephson, then Parrish. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm as you were going along, a couple of things occurred to me, but I could pass on to Representative Rauscher. I have several things here. I have to kind of get keyed up again. So go ahead.
Okay, Representative Rauscher. Yeah.
Madam Chair, thank you. I appreciate it. During your report, you said six wells were taken on by Aurora Exploration. And that left 10
13.
By the previous operator, 13 by the previous operator? Okay, well, that's fine. It doesn't matter. And you said, fortunately for the state of Alaska, Siriland was where they reside.
Through the chair, 10 are on Siriland and 3 are on state land.
Okay, well, then that might answer my question. So what you're asking for is bonding for the 3, not the 10. Because the 10 are still on Siri land, and they would fall into the same premise of what you said before.
Through the chair, Representative Rauscher, Siri's going to have to pay to plug and abandon the wells that are on Siri land.
Right.
The state, being the landowner of the other 3, is going to have to plug and abandon those 3.
Okay, so it's just those other, through the chair. So it's just those other 3 is what we're talking about.
Through the chair, yes.
Okay. I just wanted to get the understanding correctly. Thank you.
Your arithmetic is important. Yeah, thank you.
Okay, Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I have a number of questions. A posted $600,000 bond, what kind of cash would that require for the bondholder? Do you have any idea? So I'm just trying to get a sense when you say that, for example, BP has 1,900. It's obviously not 1,900 times 600,000. To cover an amendment, which hasn't been drafted, of course, yet, would cost what portion of $600,000?
This is Commissioner Forster, and I'll take this question through the chair. Representative Josephson, the cost of a bond is really dependent on the financial stability of the company. It costs BP and Exxon a lot less to get a bond than it does you or me or a little company.
Okay.
Follow up?
Somewhat different question, same topic, of course. Commissioner French, when you talked about Aurora Gas vis-a-vis Aurora Exploration, were you saying that they just accidentally are both called Aurora, or is this a situation where one was sort of a subcorp and therefore could only be touched in some limited way?
To the chair, there are actually two distinct corporations, and I think even we at the commission were sort of confused by that, and I think we thought we saw the same actors on both sides, but it turns out that's wrong. And more to the point, it's a very powerful concept in bankruptcy law that once a company goes bankrupt, it's done. It's over. And we even thought about trying to get Aurora Exploration to plug and abandon some of those old wells because that's all we cared about. And it turns out that's really contrary to bankruptcy law. You can't do that. And we learned a lesson there.
And one more?
Yes. So we're short on these three wells about $1.5 million is what I'm hearing. Because we have 300,000 we can capture.
Mm-hmm. To the chair, we have 200,000. We've always, it's been our practice to take $100,000 for the first well, mm-hmm. and $100,000 for the second well, and then that's your statewide bond. So most companies have $200,000 on account with the commission.
Right, and if I may follow up, the $1.5 million roughly that we're going to be out in general fund dollars, notwithstanding, I mean, I assume that we would try to seek a judgment through our AG, and we would, notwithstanding the bankruptcy filing, we would try to become a creditor that is a creditor, and try and get in the queue in some way?
To the chair, having sat through the bankruptcy hearings and having sort of gotten some feel for what's coming in versus what's going out, that's a dead end. And I'll just say that when California dealt with this issue with their platform and with the former operator, one of the more humorous lines in this letter of intent signed between the state and Exxon, the former company was known as Venoco, and when they get down to like the 8th or the 9th line, they say, the parties anticipate. First it says the California Department of Conservation is going to issue an order to Venoco telling them to plug and abandon those wells. The parties anticipate that Venoco is not going to comply with the order. That's in black and white. So I understand your impulse, which is, you know, get out there and squeeze them. But the reality is there's nothing to squeeze.
Okay, we've got a line up here. So we've got Representative Parrish, then Birch, then Drummond, and then back to Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So it looks like the overall liability is a little bit shy of $8 million, which this oil company managed to duck by folding, of which we're on the hook for about $1.6 million. Unless the bonding is also used to offset the costs of SERI, would there be any division there?
To the chair, Representative Parrish, SERI's on their own. SERI happens to have had the foresight to have bought an insurance policy against this eventuality. And one of the hearings, I was watching the SERI guy get up and leave the room to go call his insurance agent if he was going to have coverage. But I think they're in luck. I think they paid a lot of money for an insurance policy. I think Commissioner Forster wants to add something.
Representative Parrish, through the chair, while worrying about three wells is really important because it's real money, I think that this was brought up just as an anecdote. If we're worried this much about three wells, how badly are we going to be worried about 5,300 wells? Is the big picture is we need a bill. We need to improve our bonding, but that will not get us there. We need a bill that says we can go back on old operators, and we need to do other things that the ALGCC is working on, and we need to do other things that the DNR is working on. But I'm not worried about three wells. I'm worried about 5,300 wells.
Follow up?
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. So suppose I'm a big operator. I've got 1,000 wells, of which, let's say, 800 I'm not really interested in. They're not going to be super economically useful in the future, maybe on average another 5 years of life to them. Could I sell off that 900 suboptimal set of wells without any adjustment to my bonding, without any adjustment to the bonding of someone who owns maybe two?
Through the chair, Representative Parrish, we focus on operators. So if you were to sell those wells and someone stepped forward to operate them, we would analyze their strength and make them post a bond before they became the operator. We control that change of operatorship. So that's our moment to sort of take action is when they submit a change of operator form. We say, well, we need some bonding. But I think Commissioner Forster's point is well taken. That is, it's the big picture in that huge number, particularly of aging Prudhoe Bay wells. I've made two or three trips to Prudhoe Bay since I've been in this job, and it has just impressed me deeply how much that infrastructure has aged since the time I worked up there from 84 to 92. It's not a brand new spanking new oil field anymore. It's much beyond that.
Oh, follow up?
Mm-hmm.
But a company acquiring a great number of wells in the end of their life, which subsequently went bankrupt, would leave us without further recourse. Is that correct?
Unless we do a bill.
And to through the chair to Representative Parrish, that's exactly why we're here, because we see a danger that a strong presence could leave, a less strong person, a less strong financially company take over some assets and leave a much more exposure for essentially you in the state treasury in the form of taking care of a known obligation.
And if I might add, Representative Parrish through the chair, we're looking at a future that gives us three choices. A big company leaves, they sell to a little company. The likelihood that little company, we can't say that they won't be able to plug those thousands of wells, but should they not, we have three choices. We can have a backstop bill that you guys can pass that allows us to go back on a former operator. That's choice number one. I like choice number one. Choice number two is we can dig into the state's coffer, and it will be looking at billions of dollars. Well, you know, if we're talking about $1.5 million for three wells in Cook Inlet, what are we talking about for 5,300 wells? Right. So we've got a billion. We can go for billions of dollars out of a state fund that we don't have billions of dollars to be given away, or. I don't like option two. And option three is we can just leave the crap there. And a lot of it's on the North Slope, but a lot of it's in Cook Inlet where our kids and our grandkids will be playing. And we will have turned the state into a federal NPR legacy well shithole. Excuse my French. I'm so sorry. I didn't mean to say that. I apologize to all of you.
You're in line.
Sure.
Okay. We're going to move to Representative, let's see, Birch, I think, is next, and then Drummond, and then there's Josephson and Rauscher. We're going to go over by just a couple of minutes here, but we'll keep going.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair, what does it cost? I know $1.5 million for three wells, but as an old, shallow, small well driller, I'm just trying to figure out, do you have to set up a big rig over the hole, and how many wells have actually been abandoned? I'm assuming we've abandoned some, and I'm just curious about the mechanics. I mean, just do you pump a bunch of grout down the hole and walk away, or I mean, what actually are the mechanics involved?
Okay, and
the cost.
This knows a lot more about it than I do.
Representative Birch, through the chair. Every well will have its own cost. Mm-hmm. There will be some wells that you can just pump a little grout down. Those will be the exception. There'll be a lot of wells that you'll have to get a rig onto. And there are wells that are right in the middle of infrastructure, and there are already rigs there. Then you can just drive the rig over, rig it up, and do the work. And then there are wells that are in the middle of nowhere that you'll have to helicopter the rig in piece at a time, and you can only do it after you've built an ice road. Mm-hmm. And so do you see what I'm saying? The cost could be as simple as attaching a hose and pumping some grout, but it's going to be huge in other places. Mm-hmm. So take your pick. Okay. Yeah, it's just a whole menu.
Yep, thanks.
Okay. Representative Drummond.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is kind of scary. This list, there's 32 operators on that list, and I understand they're not all operating right now, but at some point, I assume each of them drilled two or more wells, and therefore the state collected a $200,000 bond from each of them, which is only $6,400,000. To cover, and I assume those 5,300 wells were created by some of those operators. We got a big problem. And then Aurora Gas also deposited a $200,000 bond with the state. What happens to that in bankruptcy? Can you collect that, but that's it?
Through the chair, Representative Drummond, the bond is made payable to AOGCC. We're the only person who can collect it. For Aurora, it's basically a certificate of deposit at a local bank. And when the time comes, we're going to seize it, and then I'm going to hand it over to someone at the Department of Administration so they can deposit it in the general fund. But that's, you could, it's a little, we've never done it before, so it's a little unusual.
We've done it once.
Oh, I beg your pardon. Done it once. Seized the bond once to help pay for P&A liability.
But the bonds are limited by statute? Is it by statute?
Well, the statute says we can require a bond. Our regulations say 100, you know, not less than 100, not less than 2. But there's no upper limit except, you know, frankly, you're going to hear from industry who comes in and says, fine, you know, make me pay a bond. Every dollar that comes out of my pocket for bonding is one less capital dollar I'm going to spend next year. That's certainly their negotiating posture. So, I mean, we're faced with a very delicate balancing act of hitting the right number that takes care of, I mean, because
bonding is not going to work the problem. We are not going to be able to collect adequate bonds. We're not going to get $1 billion worth of bonds.
Commissioner Forster is absolutely right. That sums it up nicely.
Well, I just want to
just follow up, Madam Chair.
Oh, pardon me.
And,
yes.
And the state can't take that $200,000 and buy an insurance policy with.
The state can take the $200,000 and buy. I mean, I guess it's possible that we as a state could engage in the same business that Siri engaged in, which is buying an insurance policy for that liability. I think that's risky.
Representative Drummond, through the chair. To say that they bought an insurance policy is a very simplistic approach. What they did was they, before they approved the sale to Aurora Gas from the old operator, they made the old operator sign a promissory agreement saying that he would be responsible for plugging and abandoning the wells should the people he was selling to not be able to. He still exists. He still has money. They have gone back on him, and he's going to plug the wells. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's kind of like an insurance policy, but it was more similar to what we're asking you guys to consider, having the ability to go back on the old operator.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, we have Josephson and then Rauscher and then come back to Johnson. Or do you have one?
Well, maybe I could sneak in there before Rauscher gets a second bite at it.
Okay, Rep. Josephson.
So, thank you, through the chair. To the extent you mentioned what the industry's position might be, if, for example, BP has 1,900 wells, the cost is not going, as you said, to be 1,900 times, obviously, 600,000. It's going to be a few thousand per bond, is sort of the sense I'm getting, because they're sort of self-insured. I mean, I don't know if that makes any sense, but I guess I'm just trying to gauge, given that the cost of P&A has gone up, and that's really sort of what we're here about in a sense, I'm trying to figure out what the retort could be other than what you've said, that it's a dollar that can't go somewhere else.
And to the chair, I think they'll say, look, look at our history. We take care of our responsibility. In the history of the state, you know, there's been very few instances where, you know, this sort of falls back on the state. I think that's kind of the nature of insurance and the nature of sort of long-range issues, which is they don't pop up every day. You're just trying to be careful. You're trying to stay ahead of something. They're going to say, look, we plug wells regularly. We plugged 10 last year, and we're going to plug 20 this year. And you know, they're aware of this. They're not neglecting it. We just feel like it's a much bigger liability than gets discussed at regular intervals, and so we appreciate this opportunity to discuss it today, and we think that it's prudent for the state to have that backstop of a law that lets you look to the last guy.
My last question real quickly is, obviously, the bond would apply, obviously, on private land to Siri. And so they would have to have the same $600,000 requirement, prospectively.
Through the chair, you know, we're going to take each operator one at a time. We just don't have a cookbook response. I'm not sure we're going to multiply wells times 600,000.
Okay.
To come up with a number.
Okay. It's well, 5,000 wells times 600,000 is a $3 billion problem. Just for our own math. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I was going to ask that question. If we're talking about taking some number like 500,000 or 600,000 and multiplying it by every well that we have out there, if the goal is to have a bond that we encourage people that will be sizable enough for people to take action that they want to get that bond back? Or is it to, you know, cover the state's cost on every dime that it might possibly cost in the future? I guess it started out, you know, this is a very dark problem. It's a huge problem. And then I thought I heard that there's only one time that we went after the bond. Is that right? Or how many times have we went after the bond?
Representative Johnson, through the chair, we have only had cause to go after the bond one time, and we did. We now have another opportunity to do that with Aurora Gas, and we will. But the problem isn't going to be solved by a bond, and the problem isn't going to be solved by a bill. The problem of having thousands of wells in the state, and all of which will become an idle well eventually if it's not plugged, it's going to require several steps. One step that we're already taking at the ALGCC is we've instituted a year or so ago a process with every operator. Every operator comes in once a year, and they tell us. We review with them every idle well they've got, and what's its future utility, what's its mechanical condition. And after those reviews, we agree on, okay, you have next year, you're going to plug and abandon, get rid of, clean up this list of wells. And then the next year, we're going to look at this again. And so that's a step. We started that, and we're doing that with every operator. We're going with every operator through their idle well inventory and trying to lower it year by year. Another step will be reviewing our bonding process and trying to make it more realistic. But as Representative French, Commissioner French, whatever you are now, said, bonding is not going to be the solution by itself. Another part of the solution is working with you guys to get a bill that allows us to go back on other operators. And another part of the solution that you've never heard mentioned before that I'd like to see is to consider an idle well fund. So and what that would look like is, all right, Operator X, you have 100 idle wells. However many wells you show up with next year, it's going to cost you $100 a well if that well is still idle. And if that well is still idle a year from now, it's going to cost you $500. And if that well is still idle a year after that, it's going to cost you $1,000, and it's going to go up. And put that money into an idle well fund that we can use for cleaning up, for plugging and abandoning wells. It'll do two things. It'll start to build us up a fund that we can use for plugging and abandoning wells, and it'll also disincentivize operators from leaving their wells idle. If that cost gets high enough, they're gonna spend the money to get out there and plug those. So I think this isn't the common cold. We don't just ignore it and hope it goes away, and this isn't an ear infection. We don't give it an antibiotic and it goes away. This one is going to take several doctors doing several different things. You guys are one of the doctors. We're one of the doctors. And another one of the doctors is DNR. As they allow operators to sell properties to new operators, they have to work DNR agreements that are more creative and more inclusive. So we've got a patient here that we all need to give attention to.
Great analogies. Did you have a follow-up?
Oh, I have so many questions on this that I don't know that I can really get through all of them. But it seems to me like, it sounds like you've taken a good step on identifying or trying to work with the wells that are abandoned. But are you having any problem with people or companies doing their due diligence on those wells on a yearly basis, as you ask? For their compliance?
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, NORDAC Energy, very small company. Like I say, two wells, one on the far side of Cook Inlet, one on the north end of Kenai. They plugged and abandoned the one on the far side of the inlet, but they haven't been able to get to the one in Kenai yet. They're a company, this is not a multi-million-dollar multinational company. They're a tiny little outfit that's trying to scrape together the money to do this job. And part of it is us putting the heat on them and DNR putting the heat on them to keep pushing them in the right direction. Commissioner Forster many years ago said something that I've remembered that's absolutely true. We probably spend 80% of our effort working with 20% of these companies. While we do worry about the large number of wells that Conoco and BP have and Hillcorp, you know, they're also huge companies that have an amazing amount of staff and amazing amount of people putting energy into these. It's the tiny little outfits that give us a lot of fits.
So, follow up, Madam Chair. Okay, and so how much did Exxon settle for? Do you know what that settlement was?
I will get with you after the hearing, and I'll give you if I could, through the chair, Representative Johnson, and give you some information about that.
All right. I just want to make one more statement. It feels like there's a lot of concern, and maybe there should be concern on this, but I'm feeling like we're not going to have 5,200 wells come end at one point. There's got to be good operators out there. I mean, it's like I would think our big three are working with us. I guess I feel like there's got to be a spectrum of concern, and how and we choose the amount the bond should be. We need to be very aware of what that could do as far as our development and so on.
Through the chair, Representative, I think it's an absolutely valid point, and it's something we're struggling with. You know, you don't want the number too high, or it's a penalty. You don't want the number too low, or it's not meaningful. And if there was a book I could open up somewhere and read the number, we'd have the number. But it's part of policy setting, and it's not easy.
We do have to wrap up because the next committee's in. Representative Tallarico didn't get a word in at all. Did you have your comment?
I just wanted to say that I think we should probably look at this in a little more of a risk assessment. Although I can appreciate the number of wells out there, I also realize that some have been plugged and have been taken care of. And some of these companies would probably be very responsible and work at that and take care of that. So it's kind of difficult when we say we've got X amount of wells, we're going to cover the expense for all of those. Although there are those smaller companies that do that. But just real quickly, you talked about, and obviously there are different costs associated with different wells. Via the administrative code, as the commissioners work forward to do that, will you have a tiered system for the bonding so that you actually recognize that something way out there, which requires an ice road in the outback, is a completely different cost than something that's available on the road system? So, and they're probably, Commissioner French, you're right, I know Commissioner Forster knows this too, there probably is no book you can open that says here's the formula for those things, but I'm just wondering are you looking into kind of a tiered system so that we can attach particular bond levels for particular areas?
Through the chair, Representative Tallarico, you're absolutely right. Each company is different. The well that Kalis drilled at Smith Bay is wildly different than a Swanson River well that you can drive a truck onto. I took a tour of the old Swanson River field this fall. It was a brilliant thing to do. I recommend it to anybody. It's great history, but it's a very different landscape than the North Slope landscape.
Okay, well, we really appreciate that. I want to make members know two different issues here. One, that they're able to address independent of the legislature, which is the bonding authority. Second issue is something that we're interested in looking at as a committee bill, and that's the statutory language that would allow them to go after the previous operators. And I don't know if we need to spend more time talking about that piece of it that's unrelated to the money but is related to the policy of allowing them to go back to a former operator, because we'd like to consider that as a committee bill. Okay, so I'm not seeing any opposition to that. So we'll work with everyone and let you know, because there's the two examples you gave us, which one's the best one to use, and we'll talk more about that. We will adjourn at 3:12 p.m. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your time.